It's Wednesday, April 8th, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers, and welcome to the podcast. We began the week by giving a shout out to the Great American South for them to rise up and begin fighting for an end to adult marijuana prohibition by forming some Normal chapters down there. I've been receiving lots of emails from Southerners who are looking to form Normal chapters. So if you're in the Great American South and you want to join up, send me your contact information and I'll get you in touch with these people who are starting some Normal chapters. Now, some other states have also been emailing me. I've received emails from Delaware, Indiana, Ohio, and Wisconsin, where some folks want to get active but don't have a chapter near them in their state and are looking to form a local chapter. So if you're in one of those states, Delaware, Indiana, Ohio, or Wisconsin, send me an email at stash@normal.org, and we'll get you hooked up with the people who are looking to start chapters. I also want to point you out to a new report just released by California Normal on drug detection times in drug testing when they're looking for marijuana in your urine, blood, hair, or saliva. This is Dr. Dale Gehringer's roundup of the latest scientific research on the subject. Check it out at a post at our blog at stash.normal.org. Another post you might want to check out is a really great photograph sent into us by a guy named Trevor, who at the University of Texas found that John Ashcroft, the former attorney general, was going to be speaking, and he managed to catch a candid photograph of himself and John Ashcroft and a bong. It's a funny story about how he got the photograph. Check it out at our blog at stash.normal.org. Also want to remind you that tax day is rapidly approaching. That's right, a week from today, April 15th, is the deadline for turning in your income taxes in the United States, and television crews will be all around the country at local post offices filming the people who are turning in their taxes at the last moment. So if you and your fellow Normal supporters could get out there to tax day with a sign that says, "Please tax us," or "Legalize and tax marijuana," that would make some great fodder for your evening news. Check out Normal's Tax Day protest through links at our blog at stash.normal.org. And just 5 days later is 420, and that weekend we'll be hosting all sorts of great 420 events. We're starting to get them all posted up at our Activist Agenda calendar, which you can reach at stash.normal.org/agenda. Got events in Cleveland, New York City, St. Louis, Portland, Oregon. They're all starting to fill in on the calendar. And if you want to get your event on the calendar, send me a note at stash@normal.org with the subject Activist Agenda. Now, coming up on today's Daily Audio Stash, we start with your hemp headlines. We've got a couple of stories from college chapters, as well as some legalization news from the United Kingdom and some reefer madness from Minnesota State Senator Amy Koch. Then, in our cannabis science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, we're going to be talking about his new book on substance abuse and addiction treatment. We're continuing our international week on our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, with Reggae Wednesday. And in a special exclusive, Normal executive director Alan St. Pierre interviews salon writer and blogger Glenn Greenwald, who's recently returned from Portugal and reports on the amazing success of drug decriminalization in that country. You're tuned in to the pulse of the cannabis community nationwide and around the world. It's time for your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. UC Santa Cruz Vice Chancellor warns parents to, quote, talk with your student about 420, end quote. University of California, Santa Cruz. Campus leaders are reaching out to parents of first-year students in an effort to curb the annual unsanctioned April 20th 420 Marijuana Festival this year. According to a recently sent email from Felicia McGinty, Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, delivered to the inboxes of UC Santa Cruz freshman parents, quote, I encourage you to talk with your student about his or her plans for 420. Ask direct questions about the choices they make, and express your expectations regarding marijuana, alcohol, or other drug use. Although students may not initiate discussion on this topic, your opinions and expectations can influence their behavior, end quote. The letter also details plans to ban overnight guests on campus from Friday, April 18th through Monday, April 20th, the day that the impromptu event annually attracts thousands to Porter Meadow at 4:20 p.m. to eat, inhale, or otherwise consume copious amounts of cannabis. In past years, a gray haze quickly formed over the meadow as thousands of revelers lit up and continued smoking throughout the late afternoon. While many of those participating are UCSC students, many, campus leaders have said, are not. To further discourage the event, the letter said, UCSC will limit bus service to campus, tow illegally parked cars, and further discourage those not affiliated with the university from showing up. Last year, neither parking tickets nor barricades across campus entrances could stop those who wanted to join the celebration. In her email, McGinty wrote, quote, while similar 420 celebrations occur simultaneously on college campuses across the United States, over the past 4 years, the event here at UCSC has grown in numbers, with many of the participants being visitors with no investment in our UCSC community. The growth and scale of this activity has become a concern for both the university and surrounding community, end quote. You let your child go to a school which has a banana slug for its mascot, and now you're just getting around to the don't smoke pot conversation? Face it, folks, the people want legalized marijuana, especially the younger people. We see it in survey after survey. So many times when I argue with these prohibitionists and I talk about how legalizing marijuana would reduce crime, they always talk about, well, why don't we just make rape legal? Then there'll be no more rape. Yeah, but the difference is you don't see people gathering in a field in the hundreds or thousands to rape each other. The idea of smoking marijuana is that it's a victimless crime. The people who are selling, growing, buying, and smoking it all want to be doing so. And given the chance to do it legally, I'm sure most would want to do it legally as well. These festivals that spring up around 420 aren't some kind of strange countercultural phenomenon. This is a cultural phenomenon. This is a large segment of the American population that is sick and tired of being treated differently than our beer-drinking brethren. It's time to end adult marijuana prohibition. One day at a time if we have to. Study shows United Kingdom could save £14 billion from drug legalization. From The Guardian. The report looked at four potential scenarios, ranging from no increase in drug use to a 100% rise as they become more readily available. The study concluded, quote, "Regulating the drugs market is a dramatically more cost-effective policy than prohibition, and that moving from prohibition to regulated drugs markets in England and Wales would provide a net savings to taxpayers, victims of crime, communities, the criminal justice system, and drug users of somewhere within the range of, for the four scenarios, £13.9 billion, £10.8 billion, £7.7 billion, and £4.6 billion," end quote. Titled A Comparison of the Cost-Effectiveness of the Prohibition and Regulation of Drugs, the report uses government figures on the costs of crime to assess the potential benefits and disadvantages of change. The document, co-written by Stephen Rolls, head of research at Transform, uses Home Office and Number 10 Strategy Unit reports to form its conclusions. It finds, quote, "The government specifically claims the benefits of any move away from prohibition toward legal regulation would be outweighed by the costs. No such cost-benefit analysis, or even a proper impact assessment of existing enforcement policy and legislation, has ever been carried out here or anywhere else in the world," end quote. I particularly like in this study, they hypothesize the drug prohibitionist's most hysterical warnings that legalization would lead to cannabis zombies roaming the streets because use would skyrocket. Even if drug use doubled, which is that 100% increase they talked about, they still found they would save £4.6 billion. Of course, I always say that everyone who wants to smoke pot is already smoking pot. I don't think marijuana usage would rise much at all. 84% of high school seniors already say they can access pot fairly easily. I think adult usage may rise, but that teen usage may fall to counteract that as marijuana moves into adults-only stores that check IDs for age 21 and over. We've seen teen tobacco rates fall as states raise their tobacco ages from 18 to 19, and as others more strictly enforce age 18 tobacco laws. Purdue Normal leads fight to equalize marijuana and alcohol penalties on campus. A Purdue University student group believes it now has leverage that could lead to changes in the university's residence hall marijuana policy. By a 54-46 margin, Boilermakers voted in favor of making the punishment for getting busted with pot in campus housing on par with being caught with alcohol. The non-binding student referendum was included on ballots during the Purdue student government elections held March 30th through April 1st. Results were released late this afternoon. Junior Sarah Wislocki, president of Purdue's chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML, said, quote, "Now that we have the results, we're wanting to sit down and have talks with the Residence Hall Council. When we first contacted the residence halls, before speaking with us, they wanted to know what proof we had that students would want this change," end quote. Currently, students caught with alcohol in residence halls face a range of penalties, which include referral to an alcohol education program or being kicked out of campus housing for continued violations. But residence hall contracts are terminated the first time a student is caught with marijuana or illegal drugs. NORML worked with Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation, a Denver-based group that is pushing colleges to reconsider policies around student marijuana use. Wislocki said, quote, "We're looking at it from the angle of marijuana being safer than alcohol. Students causing the majority of problems are the ones who are too intoxicated. As a woman, I'd rather be around men smoking than those who are drinking. they have less aggressive behavior. Yet, the university's policy is more lenient toward alcohol, end quote. And let's not forget that for Purdue students under age 21, a Boilermaker is just as illegal as a bong hit. Nobody ever thinks of underage drinking as using illegal drugs, but that is exactly what it is. It is illegal for a minor to even possess alcohol, let alone use it. Yet our society thinks of underage drinking as some sort of rite of passage. Senior keggers in high school are given a pass by many parents. College drinking game parties are a must for new freshmen and returning sophomores who are rarely 21 years old. And every semester, some college near you reports the sad death of a student from alcohol poisoning or a DUI crash. It's time to let our young people make the safer choice of intoxicant, marijuana, and maybe save a few young lives in the process.
Marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Minnesota Senator Amy Koch, Republican from Buffalo, on marijuana law reform. This is a part of our continuing series of Politicians on Pot, where I encourage you to write your state and federal representatives about marijuana law reform, and when they write back to you, you send it to me at stash@normal.org, and I post them up on the web so people can know where these legislators stand. Every now and then, one comes back that's just so full of reefer madness, I can't resist putting it on the stash. This is Minnesota Senator Amy Koch.
Thank you for your email regarding medical marijuana. I appreciate hearing from you on this issue. There are many reasons why Senate File 97 is not good legislation, and I do not support the bill. The proposed bill puts law enforcement at odds with federal law. The medicinal use of marijuana will still be considered a crime by the federal government, and any immunity granted under state law will not be granted at the federal level. We should not be placing our law enforcement officers in a position where they are asked to not enforce a law.
Does it bother anyone else that a state senator doesn't seem to grasp the federal separation of powers and that state and local police are not charged with enforcing federal law? Can anyone help us translate Garden Grove, California versus Superior Court of California into simple language for the senator?
The Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, released a report stating there is, quote, no sound scientific study, end quote, supporting the medical use of marijuana.
Yeah, because the FDA is possessed of the same rigorous powers of understanding as Senator Koch. I've got a plethora of sound scientific studies linked at stash.normal.org supporting the medical use of marijuana.
The state should not establish a system of dispensing an illegal drug without the FDA agreeing to its benefits.
Alcohol and tobacco, however, are perfectly fine for the state to regulate licensed dispensing of products the FDA has never agreed are beneficial.
Also, without the regulatory influence of the FDA, there is no guarantee that the drug consumed for medicinal purposes will be safe for the consumer.
I would tell you, Senator, of the multiple of people killed by FDA-approved Vioxx compared to those killed by medical marijuana, but I can't, because it is impossible to divide by zero.
Health officials also agree that smoking marijuana adds complications to treatment due to carcinogens and chemicals found in the drug and the fact that marijuana is addictive and weakens the immune system.
Wow! She finishes off a paragraph with a 7.0 Anslinger rating with a single sentence coming in at 12.5 Anslingers? These Reefer Madness readings are off the charts! In case you're keeping score, that was 4 prohibitionist lies in just 32 words. Number 1. Health officials agree? No, they don't. Or doctors wouldn't be recommending marijuana in 13 states. Number 2. Due to carcinogens? Sorry, while marijuana smoke has carcinogens, researchers have found no link and even a suggestion of anti-tumoral protection from marijuana. Plus, you don't have to smoke it. Number 3. Marijuana is addictive? Wrong. Marijuana can cause dependence in 9% of the user population, but it ain't nothing like an addiction. And number 4, weakens the immune system? Yeah, sure. That's why so many AIDS patients are using medical marijuana.
The Minnesota Family Council and law enforcement oppose this bill. Many national organizations, such as the American Lung Association, the Glaucoma Society, the Multiple Sclerosis Society, and the American Cancer Society, also oppose this bill.
Many national organizations support medical marijuana, and what you're calling oppose is merely the position stated by these organizations against the smoking of marijuana as medicine. Many of these organizations actually support increasing research into the medicinal effects of cannabinoids.
Again, thank you for your email. Please don't hesitate to contact with other comments or concerns you may have.
Don't hesitate to contact whom? Well, anyway, we will. At your phone number, which is 651-296-5981, or your email address, sen.amy.coke@senate.mn.us, or just visit stash.normal.org, where all this contact information can be found next to the state of Minnesota.
There were 765,000 marijuana arrests in 2007. That's not for dealers and kingpins, no, that's just for simple possession. Multiply that by the average cost of each arrest, and what have you got? $7.6 billion spent on people just smoking some pot. That's enough money to buy health insurance for every child that needs it. That's enough cash to adopt every stray dog and enough left over to feed it. Mr. Obama, I kinda wrote this song for you. You got my vote for change, now let's see what you can do.
Visit normal.org today. Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with Normal's look at cannabis science. We're at the middle of the week, and it's time for our dose of cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So today we wanted to talk about a new book that you're working on called Substance Abuse Treatment. And it's a subject that we bring up here a lot on the Stash with regard to marijuana. We talk about dependence and some of the studies out there that claim certain addictive properties and so on. And so I thought this book would be a great subject with not just marijuana, but we could talk in substance abuse in general. So just give us an idea, first off, what your book is about and what our readers would most get out of it.
It's an intriguing book, and I'm really happy with how it turned out. It's only 100 pages long, and it's part of this series that the American Psychological Association is sponsoring on treatments for a whole bunch of different problems. And they're, you know, designed to be short and accessible and, you know, easy for clinicians to get their hands on and, you know, make the best of. And my take-home message is really about, you know, getting folks motivated in order to change their own behavior rather than any kind of crazy, you know, hold a hammer over them in order to make them to change out of some fear of punishment. And the data are really supportive of that notion. And I also was really pleased that my editors allowed me to slip quite a bit of harm reduction stuff in here so that folks who don't have an abstinence model when they come to a therapist in order to handle some problems that might be related to drugs don't have to feel compelled that they're going to, you know, get forced into some 12-step program where they're never going to ever go anywhere near anything that's mildly intoxicating ever again. And they were really, you know, open about that idea and let me include a whole lot of novel information, not only for cannabis, but also even some of the hard drugs. And I was really grateful for that.
Hmm. When you're talking about this harm reduction model versus a sort of a 12-step abstinence model, does this get into the idea of there being responsible use versus abuse of drugs?
In fact, the data, you know, nationwide and across the world suggests the majority of folks who use drugs do so without problems. And that fact is one that freaks people out so badly that, I mean, I can, you know, really suffer just for saying so. But when you look at even our own national surveys, the number of people who've tried a drug, you know, ever in their life and the number of people who've used just in the past month, it's clear that plenty of folks try drugs and don't end up using them all the time. And those tend to focus just on use. When you actually look at data for problems, like how common is dependence and how common is abuse, you see that the rates are nowhere near the rates of use. So obviously, a whole lot of folks are out using intoxicants without a lot of negative consequences and seem to be having, you know, no sort of problem at all.
Yeah, and I can imagine that's kind of a controversial and shocking thing to bring up to the addiction and rehab community. But I always look at it, you know, with the perspective on alcohol. We don't think that everybody who drinks alcohol is an alcoholic. So why should all the people who use drugs be drug addicts? It seems to work that way for me.
That argument is so compelling, I don't even know what to say. And sometimes, you know, I run across people who still think alcohol prohibition is a great idea, and I point to caffeine. In truth, if you look at big epidemiological studies, if caffeine were suddenly wiped off the face of the earth, the rates of stroke would probably drop, maybe 10-15%. But come on, is that going to happen? And I think the idea that a lot of things may not be as safe as water, but could still be relatively safe, is something that we need to get sort of in the gray area instead of this weird dichotomous thinking of all these things are evil and should never be anywhere near anyone.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning here how your book also looks at how we entice people to get into treatment and want to treat themselves rather than, like you said, beat them over the head with some sort of threat of punishment. What are the statistics regarding this carrot versus stick sort of approach to rehab?
Well, the funny thing is, Linda Sobel, who's actually the editor for this book, has data showing that the vast majority of folks who ever have problems with a drug quit on their own. And so the folks we see in treatment are the folks who are often the most troubled and the most resistant to change. So then we get these sort of freaked out estimates of how hard it is to lay down certain substances because our treatment data are essentially biased in the first place. And any clinician in the country will tell you the folks who are adjudicated, who are there because basically the court has said that they should be there, often either don't really have serious problems but ended up in a possession bust, or they're so uninterested in treatment that you're wasting your time, or the crafty ones are basically talking the talk because they know that's what you want to hear so they can get out of there and get back to their daily lives.
You know, and I always wonder about that as an obstacle to treatment for others who could really use the treatment, that we see 58% of all the people in treatment for marijuana got there through the criminal justice system. So is that a major obstacle to getting treatment to the people who really need it? And are there other obstacles to treatment that we should know about?
Well, in fact, the whole notion of inpatient treatment for anybody with a marijuana problem is really suspect as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's not like you need a 21-day dry out period in the hospital because you've been smoking a joint every day. It just is a complete waste of a treatment bed for somebody who, you know, who's having serious problems with hard drugs, could really benefit from that kind of situation. And then, you know, we see how, basically a lot of the folks who are adjudicated to treatment from the marijuana community haven't even used in the previous 30 days before treatment. So it's obviously just an incredible waste of resources. And I have to confess, some clinicians are grateful to have those folks in there just because they're easy clients to have. But within a group setting, if your drug of choice is cannabis, the folks who, you know, have serious problems with crack cocaine or methamphetamine or heroin just look at you like you're some kind of idiot. So again, it's not a very welcoming setting for somebody who's, you know, basically gotten busted for a pot possession.
Yeah, you remind me of the Bob Saget scene in the movie Half-Baked.
Yes.
And we'll just leave it at that.
Indeed. Indeed.
Now, this book, Substance Abuse Treatment, when can we expect it to hit bookshelves?
Well, so I just got the page proofs, and I sent them back to the publisher, and if depending on how busy she is, we should see something out at the end of May.
And this is part, you were saying, it's part of the American Psychological Association?
Yeah, so the American Psychological Association's Division 12 is the clinical psychology crew, and they have books like this on, there's already one on alcohol, they're preparing one on gambling, one on, you know, just a whole bunch of different disorders, and I got to do the one on drugs, and I'm just really happy about being part of that series.
You also mentioned you were kind of surprised that your editor let you get in the things about harm reduction. Are there any other major changes from this book to maybe previous books released by the Psychological Association as far as understanding cannabis, medical marijuana, and addiction?
In fact, mine is the only one that has addressed anything related to cannabis so far. And I'm probably, after this one, you know, does as well as it can do, going to pitch something along those lines to them and see if they'd be interested.
Okay. Well, we'll just keep in touch with you, and we'll find out when that book drops, and we'll let everyone know about that and give them the links that they need as far as that goes. Well, thank you, Dr. Mitch, for telling us about this, and it is always an interesting subject for me. I kind of grew up with this background of having my father go through treatment and then become a drug treatment counselor. So I know that this stuff can work for people. I know that these treatment options are necessary for certain people that need them. We never want to dismiss that, but it's nice to have, you know, some recognition that there is a responsible use of things like cannabis and other drugs. So appreciate you being on the show today.
Oh, that's what I'm all about. Thanks so much.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. The battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling and refresh all you stashers for another day on the front lines of the drug war. Enjoy this cut from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com and visit our blog at stash.normal.org to learn how you can vote for your favorites and enter your Toker Tunes in the 2009 Marijuana Music Awards. Continuing the international theme this week, today's Reggae Wednesday song, Piece of Ganja, is by Austrian band Iripathi. Known as Austria's Most High, Iripathi are two brothers, Syrix and Professa. Popular internationally, Iripathi have performed at concerts and festivals in both Austria and Jamaica. The duo have released 4 CDs as Iripathi and have set up their own record company, Iri Vibrations Records. Their music is a diverse mix of harmonic Jamaican rhythms and slower roots to stomping dancehall beats. The duo have worked with the most famous artists of the Caribbean, like Morgan Heritage. Their philosophy is to support Austrian and European reggae artists, so they are always included on the flip side of singles that Iri Vibrations Records make with the top Jamaican stars. In the future, Iri Vibrations aim to continue to raise their presence in the international reggae community and spread their message of freedom, love, and peace worldwide. For more about Iripathi, who were nominated in 2008's Global Marijuana Music Awards, check out myspace.com/Iripathi, that's IRIEPATHIE, and iripathi.net. And, registered stashers, you can get an MP3 download of this tune. It's Iripathi with Piece of Ganja.
Just a good say so, yes. Meditation for the brain. Only weed, no cocaine.
Yes, doctor says so, yes. The truth it is, I have to confess. Officer, nobody charge me. It's more fun, peace of ganja. Clarinda, picking up on
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORMA. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORMAL, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Legalization, decriminalization, lowest law enforcement priority, medical marijuana, ganja sacrament, consumer cannabis, industrial hemp. The world of marijuana law reform involves many different aspects of cannabis that intersect nearly every public policy discussion in America, including healthcare, the economy, global climate change, law enforcement and prisons, immigration, religion, free speech, energy policy, and war. Now we take a look at how re-legalizing marijuana will change the world in our NORMAL daily audio stash, Cannabis Conversations.
Hi, this is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORMAL at the Cato Institute on April 3rd. And I'm interviewing Glenn Greenwald from Brazil, but more notably as a salon columnist and author of a new white paper on the decriminalization of drugs in Portugal. So thank you very much. I appreciate this.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. Well, quick question as we move through about 10 here. In a January post, you asked if other than the Israel-Palestine conflict, was there an issue that the people are divided on, yet politicians of both parties march in lockstep? So sort of compare and contrast the ideological rigidity on marijuana prohibition and the drug issue overall to say that of Israel.
I think the marijuana legalization might actually be an answer to that question, especially recent polling. I'm not sure that polling has been quite as encouraging in the past, but certainly recently, there's a sizable portion of the population which actually supports marijuana legalization. I think one recent poll showed it at 40 or 41%. I'm not sure that it still rises to the anomalous level of the Israeli-Palestine question, because polls have shown, for instance, that roughly 70% or more of Americans want an approach to the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, and yet advocating that position is virtually political death with extreme parties, but it's certainly close because there's a sizable portion of the American populace deeply dissatisfied with and wanting great changes in American's drug laws, and yet, at least until Jim Webb stood up and did it recently, it was virtually impossible for a politician to stay in the mainstream and advocate that view.
What do you believe is the nature of the Democratic versus GOP opposition to reform? What constituencies of either party prevent them from embracing harm reduction as an approach to policing?
I think that the way that politicians work is they take positions when they perceive that there is a substantial benefit to those positions, either in terms of popularity or in terms of financial support from industries and the like. There isn't a great organized constituency of the type that would be potent enough to change on behalf of reform of our drug policy laws and laws that may be changing to some extent. But I think they've perceived for a long time that there's substantial risk from doing something. The one thing politicians don't ever want to do is be accused of being outside of the mainstream. That they perceive is political death. And whether it's true or not, I think the perception of the political class has been that certainly legalization and even liberalization of our drug laws is something that is outside of the mainstream. And since there is really no constituency, popular constituency, on who is demanding these sorts of reforms. Maybe there's a substantial portion that wants them or tells pollsters they might be receptive to them, but there's no mass movement demanding them, at least as politicians perceive them. They continue to take the safe position. When you add to that the fact that there are substantial constituencies opposed to drug policy, where there's a huge prison state of private prison and paramilitary organizations, even the defense industry, that has a vested interest in as harsh of a drug war as possible and harsh criminalization scheme, and they use those their resources to fund lobbyists and to campaign against politicians who step out of line. You add to that the mainstream perception that drug policy reform is outside of the mainstream. Politicians perceive no incentive for them to advocate other than the status quo.
As a major denizen of the blogosphere, what is your reaction to Obama soliciting the public's policy-making priorities, both in January via change.org and again last week at his first online town meeting, and his inability to take seriously the public's clear concerns about marijuana prohibition and their desire for alternatives?
I actually found his response extremely, I would even go so far as to call it infuriating, because the idea was, and they promote this idea constantly, does the White House, that they want to bypass traditional media outlets and hear from citizens and have Obama answer questions directly from them. And yet, not only was this question near the top of some of the lists, as he said, it was number one on, I think, every one of the lists. And it's not the first time it's happened, where online polls of this sort have indicated great interest in this question. And I don't think anybody necessarily expected that he would advocate legalization. He's in the past said he opposed it. So I don't think any of the dissatisfaction was about the position that he took vis-a-vis whether he supports or opposes legalization. It was the scoffing, dismissive, even adolescent nature of his response. Not only did he chuckle and laugh snidely at the very mention of marijuana as though he was an eighth grader who cleaned himself, but he also implied that the only people who would be interested in a policy that doesn't imprison members of our fellow citizens are people who are either potheads or freaks. You know, well, I don't know what this says about people mine that they are interested in this. And I thought at the very least it was a real opportunity for one of the first times to have a serious discussion at the highest level of our political discourse about drug policy. Whatever else is true, it's not a laughing matter, given the number of people whose lives are wrecked by prohibition. And not only did he fail to seize that opportunity, he did something much worse. He reinforced the idea that it was a frivolous issue that merits no serious attention. And I thought the answer was deeply disappointing and contrary to everything he says he believes about how political issues ought to be discussed.
Amen. Yeah, I can appreciate that on many, many different levels. The nearly 40-year-old organized effort to reform marijuana laws has largely failed to recruit both women and minorities. Can you provide any thoughts or suggestions for reformers? I organize 18 normal national conferences and dozens of regionals around the country, and they are the whitest events I go to in the United States. They would make the country clubs that I grew up with on Cape Cod look like they were greatly diverse. So do you have any thoughts as a thoughtful person and as a international citizen, if you will, of how do we put together the necessary calculus to get minorities and women involved? Because I can sincerely say we will not achieve major reform until those two, I can hardly call them subsets, particularly when we're mentioning women in their majority in population. So how do we reach out to those individuals?
Well, I think, first of all, that's an issue that political activists face across the board, independent of specific issues. Much of our society is segregated and stratified, and so political activism tends also to be. It's a broader societal problem, not one specific to, say, marijuana drug policy reform, even though it manifests itself in that area. But I think specifically, there are unique aspects to drug policy debates to why that happened. Obviously, not just drug addiction, but criminalization and the harsh prohibition laws affects adversely minorities and women as much as, if not more than, any other aspect of the population. And I think the great myth of the drug policy debates has been that criminalization is necessary to restrain drug usage. And so people who live in communities where drugs are harmful won't even consider decriminalization or legalization because they believe the myth that if there's decriminalization, then drug usage will explode and that those problems will worsen. And I think the number one priority of people who advocate drug policy reform is to bring to the forefront the fact that few things are more devastating to individuals and communities than turning people into criminals and putting them into cages, into our extraordinarily brutal and degrading and devastating prison system, and that the harm that is being brought to these communities is really not from drugs per se, but from the government's reaction to drugs. That's what breaks up families. That's what takes young, primarily African-American males and essentially wrecks their futures by declaring them criminals and throwing them into our horrendous prison system. And so I think that the more that focus is on that hypocrisy namely the idea that, well, we're going to criminalize drugs in order to save these people, and we're going to save them by turning them into criminals and throwing them into prison, away from their families, breaking up families, the more that's understood, I think the more receptive those communities will be to the idea of drug policy. Mm.
The Greek term for that was iatrogenic. The class, we haven't gotten too far away from that. In support of defensive counterintuitance, the thesis of your white paper, the criminalization of all drugs in Portugal, is that in total, there was less use after 7 years, more or less. The American analogies are that in the states that have medical marijuana laws, there also has not been an increase in marijuana use, and most notably amongst youth, for which one could argue is the fulcrum of the policy. And in my lifetime, I'm 43 years old, tobacco use has been cut in half. And we didn't use the criminal justice system to reduce the instances of smoking a substance that kills, amazingly, almost 500,000 people in the United States alone, and by many accounts is more addictive than opioids. So with that, with your experience in Portugal and your extensive research, how do we convince the American public, media, and policymakers about the counterintuitancy here of trying to decriminalize drugs, in this case marijuana most specifically, and that one of the goals, believe it or not, is actually the reduction of use?
What I found most interesting about the Portuguese decision to decriminalize was that it was motivated by an attempt to decrease usage. It was not some libertarian ideology that drove it. It was not that the society was some sort of idyllic nirvana, upper middle class bliss that enabled them to eliminate their drug laws. It was that they had an out of control drug problem of addiction and spiraling pathologies throughout the 1990s, and decriminalization was an attempt to decrease usage, and it worked. And the reason it worked is because by eliminating the stigma and the fear on the part of the citizenry that they'll be turned into criminals if they use drugs, it enables citizens to seek out from their government treatment and to identify themselves as addicts and to get the sort of counseling and harm reduction opportunities that they want. And more importantly, it frees up enormous resources when you're not spending money on imprisoning and arresting and prosecuting huge numbers of nonviolent drug addicts. There's huge amounts more money available for treatment programs, for methadone needle exchanges, and the like. And so you can actually provide treatment to addicts who want it, and addicts are much more able in a decriminalized setting to turn themselves into non-users. That's clearly what's happened.
Do you see that the positive experience in Portugal is going to be transplanted to Brazil, for example? Do you see that the mother country, if you will, is going to teach the bigger, larger colony on the world scale a lesson here and move towards decriminalization?
I think it's a difficult question. On the one hand, the Brazilians have as horrific of a problem, not just with drugs, but with prohibition, as any country in the world. The violence between the state and citizens that arises, and the militarized police state there is difficult to put into words. At the same time, they're clearly amenable to the view that the drug war has failed. In fact, a former Brazilian prime minister, who's widely respected within all of Latin America, was one of the four Latin American leaders who recently declared the drug war to be a failure. So to me, the more the focus is on the empirical question about what works and the ideological and moral aspects are stripped out of the debate, the more likely drug reform will be everywhere in Brazil and elsewhere.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We'll leave you today with reminders to check out the Activist Agenda at stash.normal.org/agenda for all the Tax Day and 420 weekend protests that are planned. Also, check out our activist alerts so that you can find out which bills are still going through the legislatures and you can make your voice heard. And our quote of the day brought to you by Mr. Spoff, this one from Mark Twain, the American author and humorist, who said, quote, "Each man must for himself alone decide what is right and what is wrong, which course is patriotic and which isn't. You cannot shirk this and be a man. To decide against your conviction is to be an unqualified and excusable traitor, both to yourself and to your country. Let men label you as they may," end quote. It's not easy coming out of the cannabis closet and standing up for your rights, but that's what we're doing here at The Stash. Thanks for downloading the podcast, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.